Our scripture reading this morning is found in Galatians chapter 5, verses 1, and then verses 13 and 14. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. For you were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Last week, one of the presidential candidate hopefuls, made the following statement at a campaign stop, quoting now, "I have opponents in this race who do not want to change the Constitution, but I believe it's a lot easier to change the Constitution than it would be to change the Word of the living God. And that's what we need to do, is to amend the Constitution so it's in God's standards, rather than changing God's standards so it lines up with some temporary view of how we treat each other and how we treat the families." I don't know how much attention it generated in the general public and media, but it was certainly picked up by those concerned with the continued separation of church and state, and this included the Religious Liberty Department of the North Pacific Union Conference. I got an email with that quote on it, which is why you see it, or which is why I read it today. Christianity Today, considered the leading evangelical Christian magazine, also took note because a couple of days later there was an online poll that queried visitors about whether or not the Constitution ought to be changed. This unscientific poll result was as follows. 5% said yes to bring it in line with God's standards. 35% yes to define things like marriage and life so that they don't continue to be redefined by judges. 6% yes for other reasons. 14% no. It's not just another piece of legislation. It's our standard. 33% no. The Constitution does not need to be changed. And 7% no for other reasons. So overall, 46% believed the Constitution needed changing, while 54% opposed the changing of the Constitution. Now, I personally find the results both encouraging and a little disturbing. Encouraging because the majority believes that the Constitution is not something that should be trifled with casually as a means of incorporating one perspective of a moral society. Disturbing because nearly half have forgotten or have never learned the history of this nation. Protection of minority views, particularly when it comes to opinions formed through the interpretation of religion, is arguably one of the bedrock principles of this nation. Many of the founding communities were oppressed religious minorities. The bicameral Congress, you know, the House and the Senate, in theory anyway, gives equal power to both the larger and smaller states, both the majority states and the minority states. At least in part, in the past, this nation believed not only in the free marketplace of commerce, but also in the free marketplace of ideas. In recent years, I've been seeing the marketplace of ideas being dismantled, however. The attitude on both sides seems to be my way or the highway. Both sides appear intent on invoking the entire political machinery to enforce and cast in stone what they view to be right. The call to change and amend the Constitution is the most extreme step. By doing so, proponents seek to bypass all legislative, executive, and judicial reviews. It bypasses the checks and balances that were written into this very Constitution in order to protect the rights and freedoms of minority groups. Christians, in particular, are feeling threatened by the rise of secularism and atheism. Why? I wonder, is it because for so long Christians have been in the majority, or at least their views have, and have become used to having society run the way that they believe it should be? Could it be that Christians have become comfortable with the power, the privilege, the popularity, the authority, and acclamation that comes as a part of being the majority? Have Christians become so wedded to this world, that they've forgotten that they are not citizens of this world? Is that why the reaction to the real and perceived threats have been primarily to use this world's powers to protect what they have? Now, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, and growing up that way, I picked up somewhere, probably in some history or government class, that the idea that the call for constitutional change was the gateway to suppression of religious liberty in the future. And specifically, the warning was that the Constitution would be used to enforce religious beliefs and practices that would be at odds with Adventists, or to prevent the practice of those things that Adventists believe are God's standards. Now, for many years, it sure didn't seem very likely that that would happen. And so that warning grew kind of dusty and cobwebbed somewhere in the back of my mind. But in recent years, I'm starting to come back again and starting to clean up some of that dust that I've been collecting. It doesn't seem quite so far-fetched today that something could happen in this country to significantly alter the church-state relationships and the basic principle of freedom of conscience and the liberty to practice one's religious beliefs. Whenever the church is granted political power and wields it, the results are disastrous. Whenever the state resorts to employing religion to persuade and coerce, the results are also tragic. You know, I don't have to look deep to see both occurring in this nation today. Politicians on both sides, it doesn't matter if you're liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, libertarian, whatever it is. Now, politicians on all sides are increasingly employing religion to try to win voters to the polls, to try to win voters to their side. Religious groups are increasingly playing the political game, trying to increase the power and influence they wield over the political process. The goal, explicit or not, I believe, is to influence the state to make their religious views the law of the land. When I look at today's politics and today's religion, I fear what could take place. The history of Europe is littered with the results of such unions. And the Middle East today shows us in real time, every day, what happens when the state relies on religion and religion relies on the state. When the political state receives its mandate, legitimacy, and authority from religion, it inevitably has to support the religious systems that support it. Dissenting religious beliefs and systems become a threat to the nation, and they are suppressed and destroyed. And the reverse is also just as true. When a religious system becomes convinced it is right, it seeks to destroy all who would challenge it. And the best way to obtain the civil powers necessary to coerce and force is to support the political state. Whenever a religious power gives its support to a political state, it is not the state that is changed, but the religion. Religion becomes transformed into a tool of the devil. And perhaps one might even see it as the devil himself personified in that combination. That's the devil. Jesus was the victim of such a union. Jesus was the victim of religion. A religion that thought it was right and had become used to power, privilege, popularity, authority, and acclamation. A religion that was threatened by Jesus because he demonstrated true power, because he didn't claim any privilege, yet he was the truly privileged one, because he gained popularity without seeking it, because he had true authority, and because he received acclaim that he didn't claim for his own, but directed right up to his Father. Lazarus was the motive. Religion was the weapon. All that remained to be decided was the time and place. And so we pick up in John chapter 11, verse 45, right after Lazarus is resurrected. reading, "Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.' But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish.' He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, 'What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?' Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him." The Pharisees were the religious party. They were the conservatives, the political right of the day. The priests belonged to the Sadducees, the secular party, the liberals, the political left of their day. As odd and strange as that may seem to us, that was the reality. Rome gave her provinces a measure of autonomy, and what political power was available to the Jews was held by the Sadducees and led by the priests. The Sadducees had originally been just a political group, but in order to bolster their standing and authority, they employed religion and theology to support their positions and their arguments as to why they should be the rulers. The Pharisees, on the other hand, wielded the religious power. In their ranks were the scribes, frequently addressed as rabbi. They were the interpreters of the law. They were given authority to bind and loose in heaven according to the law. In other words, they presumably had the power to determine what God would disallow or allow according to their interpretations of the law. They were zealous for their God, but even more zealous about the law. To them, the Sadducees and therefore the priests had sold out to Rome. The priests had been under the influence of the liberal pagan ideas for so long that they were really Jews in ancestry only. And so the Pharisees longed for the day when the Messiah would appear to get rid of all of these pagan influences from their nation and from their culture. These two groups were naturally not friends. "But the enemy of my enemy is my friend." So the saying goes. And I believe that's kind of what we just read in the passage. Now, up until this time, Jesus threatened mostly the Pharisees and their religious authority. The Sadducees were probably taking some delight in this, seeing their rivals being humiliated by an uncredentialed teacher from Galilee. Lazarus' resurrection, however, turned the tables on the Sadducees. Because you see, the Sadducees didn't believe the resurrection was possible. One of their central teachings was all of a sudden discredited. And if they were wrong on that point, what more had they taught that was wrong that people would suddenly come to realize? Jesus was threatening their interpretations of the law and thus their arguments for holding power. The parties, so up until now, had been able to keep power over the people and had prestige and privilege. They had authority over the people in different arenas, but they had authority, and they received acclamation from them. But Jesus was discrediting and deconstructing all the power and structures and systems that they strove to build and maintain. Their fear was that they would lose control of the people and anarchy would result as everyone followed after Jesus. Even today, religious systems are maintained and even grown because of fear of what might happen if systems are dismantled. In both cases, ancient and today, those who seek to maintain systems based on fear just might have an overinflated view of themselves and the power that they really have. In any case, the two rival parties came together to plot Jesus' death, to save their own skins, really, and to maintain power, prestige, and privilege, their authority and acclamation. And so, therefore, the council branded Jesus as a threat to national security. He was branded essentially as a terrorist, one who spread dangerous ideas and was inciting a rebellion. An APB was issued to bring him into custody. Isn't it ironic that in the end, about 40 years later, Rome did come and take away everything and destroy the Jewish nation? Isn't it ironic that the effort to preserve the nation as God's chosen one resulted in its destruction? Isn't it ironic that this act of narrow-minded nationalism would turn out to be the greatest blessing that the world would ever see? It just goes to show that God is able to work through even the worst evil to bring about good. Although I'm sure God would have preferred them to have accepted Jesus, and none of this destruction would have taken place. Most Seventh-day Adventists believe that there will come a time when state and church will unite to enforce a particular brand of religious standards for the greater good of all. We believe that this will occur at the close of the earth's history in the moments leading up to Jesus' coming. Some of these Adventists, unfortunately, however, jump to the conclusion that if this church-state union is necessary for Jesus to come, then it must be a good thing. And so they come to the conclusion that they should do all they can to make it come about. And for them, then, religious liberty is at best useless and at worst a tool of the devil. And I believe that their reasoning comes dangerously close to the logic Judas used in betraying Jesus. Judas attempted to control God, and those who seek to cause events to occur according to their interpretations of prophecy are also, I believe, seeking to control God. I think we can learn from Jesus' example on how to respond. Throughout his life, although he could not avoid all conflicts, he did all he could to prevent conflicts from flaring into raging fires. Even now, as the fire was beginning to burn uncontrollably, Jesus chose to remove himself from the most volatile area because it wasn't quite time that his Father had set for him to begin his final march to the cross. So Jesus, being God and knowing what he would go through, even he did not attempt to force his Father's hand. There was still precious time left for him that he believed was essential in preparing his disciples for the time that was about to come. And likewise, I believe that it is critically important for Seventh-day Adventists to do all they can to put out and control flames that threaten to destroy religious liberty and freedom of conscience. There's still time to witness to the world. We need to use the time that we have and to lengthen it as much as we can. The basic principle of God's kingdom is love. Love cannot exist without freedom, without liberty. Last week we read from Luke 4 where Jesus proclaimed his mission was to set people free, physically and spiritually. Freedom and liberty are at the core of the gospel. Coercion and force are the enemies of the gospel. So that's why we should and must resist efforts that threaten to destroy religious liberty and support efforts that seek to establish and maintain it. You see, I believe that God's adversary, Satan, wants to keep people trapped and captive to the wrong pictures of God. Coercive and oppressive forms of religion help paint that same picture. Religious liberty, on the other hand, makes it possible for God to have people see his real portrait. I may be wrong, but I think that many Seventh-day Adventists have been asleep the past few decades. Maybe some still are. We've forgotten that church and state must remain separate, and the wall between them must remain high. However, too many of us, I fear, are setting our hopes on politicians and laws to promote our causes. Too many of us, I fear, are secretly desiring an earthly Messiah. Keep in mind the warning that powers of this world will corrupt, transforming even good religion and good intentions into a devil and a demon. So we must never relinquish our freedom of conscience, our liberties. We must never, never, never accept the tempting offers of political power in return for our support. We must never, never, never come to the point where we identify more with politics than we do with Jesus. If you really want to preserve your liberties, I'd suggest don't even start on the path to identifying with any political group. Be a maverick. Be a radical. Be absolutely independent of worldly control and influence. Follow the example of Jesus. That said, those who take a position in favor of full religious liberty or full freedom of conscience, I believe, will eventually find themselves opposed by both the left and the right, because freedom is a threat to anyone who seeks to control, who seeks to have power over another. Now, we're not going to have to go looking for trouble. It's going to come to us. As Christians, as Christ's representatives, I believe we must stand up and support liberty. Jesus came to free people from all sorts of things, including wrong religious ideas. And I believe Jesus wants his work to continue through us. It must continue through us. Now, we are his hands. We are his feet. We are his voice. And so as each of us makes choices about what causes to lend our voices, our time, and our money to, as we make choices this coming year about who it is that we want to have represent us, I urge you to consider the following qualities: love, liberty, and life, evidenced through compassion and caring. Don't let your religion become a murder weapon. Rather, let it become an instrument of love, liberty, and life.